Welcome to the brightest audience in the nation, to the Bob Benyart Live Telethon. During our telethon, we're offering a free gift, Bob's video series, Having a Great Prayer Life, when you become a new subscriber to any of our monthly subscriptions. Our newest product, our monthly sermon audios on standard compact disc, allows you to listen to the sermon on any CD player, including the one in your car. You can also get the monthly sermons on MP3 CD, or you can get the video version of the monthly sermon videos on DVD. Bob's monthly Bible studies are now available on DVD or MP3 CD. These are great for starting your own family Bible study or a neighborhood Bible study. And Bob's monthly topical videos give you a new topical video each month. And with the best of Bob, you can get the best 8 Bob Benyart Live shows every month. By becoming a new subscriber to any of Bob's monthly products, making a new monthly donation of $20 or more, or a one-time donation of $50, you'll receive the video series, Having a Great Prayer Life, free of charge, special for the Bob Benyart Live Telethon.
One warning is to the head. It gets beyond all the headlines you read. Don't need lip service with a wink and a nod. You need a man on a mission from God. Well, not to worry, here's Bob Benyart Live.
Welcome to another episode of Real Science Friday. I'm Bob Benyart. Mutations are random. True? The changes to our DNA, they're just random. No rhyme or reason to them. Is this true? Well, there is a dad who has had a couple kids who were born with genetic diseases, and he is working hard to educate people to the truth about mutations. And this is a startling truth, that many mutations are not random. I'd like to welcome to Real Science Friday, Jonathan Bartlett. Jonathan, welcome to Real Science Friday.
Bob, thanks so much for having me on.
Well, it's an honor. Jonathan, you have founded the Blythe Institute. You're not a professional scientist, right? Like me, I think. You are an interested layman in these issues.
Exactly. I started researching my two children with genetic diseases. The oldest one died when he was 5 and a half.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Jonathan.
In that time, I had to spend a lot of time researching genetics to understand how to better help them out. Mm. I spent years studying all sorts of genetics from, mostly at that time, it was studies as far as trying to help and maybe find a way to make things better.
Mm. Jonathan, I'm so very sorry that this has happened to you. We know that we have a very loving God, and it'll be exciting to see your children in all the health and wonder that God intended for them someday. You listen to Real Science Friday from your home. You're in Oklahoma, is that right?
I'm in Oklahoma. I listen to the podcast.
You listen to the podcast. And Jonathan, by the way, this week, Oklahoma had their primary. And such an interesting thing, a friend of our program, Randall Terry, he actually beat Barack Obama in the Democratic primary in Oklahoma in 12 counties, which is...
I heard about that.
Yeah, which is really fun. Randall, by the way, is the pro-personhood founder of Operation Rescue, and he's actually earned a delegate to Obama's DNC convention this summer, and he's been running to try to get pro-life Democrats to wake up and stop supporting a pro-abort, and also to expose what abortion really is by showing the aborted children on TV, because as a federal candidate, the stations have to carry his campaign ads. So we'll have to congratulate Randall Terry. But back to our topic, Jonathan. It is an honor to have you on the show. You have published an article in a technical journal put out by Answers in Genesis. You have a YouTube video out. And so, yeah, let's talk through this, because, of course, we have all learned in school that mutations are random changes to the genes, to the DNA that we have in our human genome, and with all plant and animal species also. We've all learned that this was random.
Yeah, and I want to, you know, clarify that there are, in fact, random changes, but that's not necessarily the rule. Just like hearts have heart attacks,
Right.
Your cells, there's a natural mutation process that happens in your cells. Sometimes it goes bad, but usually it's operating according to the structure of the cell.
In other words, there are orchestrated changes that were put into the functioning of living organisms so that changes would occur to the code. It's like the computer code that helps to build proteins and assemble the physical bodies of organisms. They were designed to change intentionally, which is just so mind-boggling. But could we back up and talk about changes when scientists first started to study mutations? They tried experiments like you mentioned in your YouTube video, cutting the tails off of mice. So they would do that, and what did they find out by doing that?
When you cut tails off mice generation after generation, the mice still have tails.
Right, exactly.
So just because you do something to a creature doesn't mean that they inherit that change.
Mm-hmm. And so, of course, there were evolutionists who were thinking that if a creature jumped a lot, his kids would be born with stronger muscles in his legs so he could jump. Or if creatures would jump out of trees, their kids would be born maybe with sort of the beginnings of feathers growing on their arms, or if you work out a lot or whatever. But it turns out that those kinds of external factors don't get transferred to your offspring.
Not usually. There are some creatures that if you raise them in the water of their predators, they'll actually change their body structure to help defend themselves against that predator.
Well, that is absolutely true. We've talked about that. There are fish that if there are no predators in a lake, they will have, for example, fewer offspring, and their offspring will take longer to mature, whereas when scientists have introduced a predator into their environment, then they lay more eggs, and their offspring mature more quickly to try to survive with the predator. Those are examples, I think, of not random mutations, but as you say, and you're rightly correcting me, external influences for which the genome is designed to take in information and make adjustments accordingly. That's an example of where an external factor can affect our genome. But Jonathan Bartlett, aren't there things that happen in our bodies every day, countless times over, where what looks like mutations actually, they might be called mutations, but they're evidence of designed changes?
One of the most amazing things in your body is the way that your body responds to foreign antigens that come in.
Like germs?
Yeah, like germs.
All right, bacteria, virus, and so on.
So what happens is that your body already has about several million different antibodies that each fit a different type of germ.
All right.
The process that those are made is amazing to begin with, but that's a different subject.
So in other words, these antibodies, they're like little weapons that are in our cells and carried around in our bloodstream. And if I get some bacteria because I touched a doorknob that somebody was sick, had a cold, they open the door, I touch it, I rub my nose, and now I have a virus in my body, I have antibodies, and you're saying we actually have several million different kind that are designed to target specific germs.
That's right.
Wow.
And then if there's a new germ that your body hasn't seen before,
all right,
what it will do is it'll take an antibody and it will mutate the correct half of the correct gene until it finds a better fit. You've got about 3 billion base pairs in your genome. And so it skips over those and focuses it on the right 600 that it needs to look at.
Oh, my. So out of 3 billion base pairs of amino acids, you said the right 600. That's because you're taking half of the antibody base pairs. Yeah, is that right?
Yeah, because what happens is half of it goes to attach to the antigen, and the other half goes to alert the immune system.
Okay, you know, so out of 3 billion base pairs of amino acids, it's like a ladder, a spiral staircase with 3 billion rungs on the ladder, 3 billion steps. And out of those, there are 1,200 that help our antibody system attack antigens. And out of those 1,200, so we're talking about 0.001% or so of our genome. And out of those 1,200, only half of those are the part that attaches to the germ. Am I picturing this correctly?
That's exactly right.
And you're saying that the mutations that are needed, the changes in that code, they occur just in that right part. Not only, obviously, other mutations can occur, but that's the targeted zone for mutations to occur so your body can now attack this new germ.
That's exactly how it happens.
Wow. How well known is this, Jonathan Bartlett? Because you're doing your best to alert us, the creationists and the Christians, that something that the world thinks are merely harmful were actually designed by God for our protection and our welfare. How well known is this feature of the genome?
Well, it kind of depends on who you ask. This particular part is actually very well known. The problem is that it gets very misconstrued, because within those 600 base pairs, it's somewhat random within those 600. So it doesn't know exactly which ones it needs to change. So it just kind of tries them at random until it finds the right combination.
Right. And if you're designing a program to attack some kind of a structure and you don't know in advance what the structure is going to look like, well, then that seems reasonable that you would try different weapons, so to speak, against this structure, looking for a vulnerability.
Yeah. And because there is a random part of it, this is actually used by many evolutionists as a prime case of how random mutations can cause beneficial changes.
Right.
They just ignore the fact that there's a lot of information in the genome pointing it to the right location to make the changes.
Yeah, because if these mutations were merely random, then they wouldn't be targeted primarily with such frequency of change to these 600 base pairs out of 3 billion, and they would also equally be targeted to the other 600, which are there to alert the immune system to the problem. So this is extraordinary evidence of design.
Yeah, and there's a lot of places in biology where this happens. The problem is that anytime organisms don't necessarily know exactly what they need. So within any sort of search for a new mutation, there's going to be some amount of randomness. People who are committed to the random mutation idea take any hint of randomness and they assume that that's the rule rather than the exception. So if you have this process that excludes most of the genome, they're still going to call it random mutations, even though it's carefully orchestrated.
Hey, could we take a moment to talk about the evidence for design? It's so interesting to me, Jonathan, that evolutionists will, many of them, many atheists, many evolutionists, will deny in principle that there's any way to look at something and to determine whether or not it was designed. I mean, that is so absurd to me. We are beyond the twilight zone when we're trying to talk to evolutionists about intelligent design, which I think you've put your finger on something that's a wonderful example of evident design. But I'd like to give an example. I don't know if you've considered the Piltdown Man as an example of the evolutionist and the atheist acknowledging intelligent design. They thought there was this alleged ancestor of man, this hominid, was discovered back in like 100 years ago, I think 1912, in England. And they said, well, lo and behold, look at this. The Piltdown Man is a missing link. It's one of our ancestors between apes and humans. But then a half a century later, it was exposed as a forgery. It was shown to be a forgery, and that someone, but they don't know who, deliberately combined different bones to make us think that it was a hominid. And so I think that's a great example of even the evolutionist admitting that they could identify intelligent design. They don't look at this thing and say, wow, look at that. Some creature evolved to look exactly like that. They look at it and they see the evidence that different bones of different creatures were deliberately combined with the skull of a modern human to put forth a hoax. So they use evidence of intelligent design all the time. When they themselves expose the Piltdown Man, they know exactly what we mean by intelligent design, but they're afraid to acknowledge that they know what that means.
And it's not just there. There's been other examples of scientific misconduct that have been found on the same basis. There was a physicist whose results were not reproducible, and his career was over the day that they found the noise in two of his experiments were the same.
Were identical.
Yes. And that is not something that happens arbitrarily. That's something that can only happen if he's copying his data and inserting it himself.
Mm-hmm.
I would say that one of the issues with design, there's a philosophical issue that sometimes gets missed. I talk to people about creation and evolution a lot, and the biggest difference between a creationist and evolutionist is not about our theory of the past. It's about our view of the present. Because as a human, I believe that we have not only a body, but also a soul.
Right.
Now, if we evolved, then the idea of a soul is almost meaningless.
Yeah.
Because where did we get it?
Right. Like, for example, neurosurgeons could study the brain forever until the cows come home. And they're never going to find the mind. They could study the brain forever and ever, and they will never come across the mind. So our consciousness, our being self-aware, these things are not physical. Ideas are not physical. The laws of logic, reason, none of these things are physical. Mathematics, these are not physical. Yet, more than anything else, they define what we are, who we are, and they define reason and rationality.
If you think about it, if you imagine yourself not believing in those things, so if you didn't believe that we had a soul, and you thought that we ourselves are just a material process, then the idea of design as indicating a non-material process doesn't make sense. Because if we design something, if we were just machines, then our designs would not have any special properties.
Mm-hmm.
It would be just as much a part of nature as everything else.
Right. Sure.
And so the way that the argument from design works is by assuming that we are, in some sense, above the material. Mm. So it's hard to have a conversation about it. Because if you don't share that starting assumption, then it's hard for them to even understand what the argument is.
Well, I had an on-air debate. I'm now in a written debate with one of the nation's leading atheists, Aaron Ra. The debate's over on a website in England called League of Reason. And on air, I brought up the area of forensic science with Aaron Ra, and I tried to get him to acknowledge that that's an area of science that does a tremendous job distinguishing between natural causes versus causes that were brought about by intelligence, intelligent design, so that if you find a dead body, then this person may have died of natural causes like a heart attack, or perhaps there's a gunshot wound in the person's head, and the person's blood is on the front door of a house in someone's fingerprint. And you trace that fingerprint, and you find out that it's an ex-boyfriend. Then the forensic scientist comes along and says, this was not from natural causes. This was designed. This was an intellect. This was intentional, something with intent. And I tell you, Jonathan, Aaron Ra acted as though he could not tell the difference between something with intent, done by intelligence and something of a natural cause.
And that's very common. There's a paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences that said you have no more free will than a bowl of sugar.
Right.
It amazes me that people can make such statements with a straight face, but it happens all the time. And that's, you know, one of the things in intelligent design, even as non-scientists, I think we can all recognize that the most common thing in nature is our experience of it. The most common thing in nature is the choices we make. And so if you have a philosophy that denies your experience and your choices,
right,
then it's probably a bad philosophy.
Well, yeah, and to deny free will, in fact, I like to use the term will, and it turns out that some people say we have a will, but they don't really mean that. So then we add the word free. We say free will. And then those people started saying, well, we believe in a free will also. So then we've had to add libertarian free will. And eventually those same people are going to start saying, well, we believe in a libertarian free will, when they don't. But you've heard of the evolutionist William Provine. He was a professor of biology at Cornell, and I believe he passed away. He's in Expelled, that great documentary by Ben Stein. And in that movie, he said that he had brain cancer, and if it resurfaces, then he might even kill himself. Well, I have here an excerpt from a speech that he made on Darwin Day back in the 1990s. And he said something affirming what you just pointed out, Jonathan Bartlett. He said that evolution has clear consequences, that there are no gods worth having, that there's no life after death, there's no foundation for ethics, there's no meaning in life, and human free will is non-existent. And so you're right, there have been many evolutionists who have said this, and in fact, Aaron Ra accused a leading creation ministries of saying that evolution equals atheism, that if you believe in evolution, you have to be an atheist, which I've never asserted because we fight with theistic evolutionists all the time. But William Provine, he actually said this. He said, religion is compatible with evolution only if religion is effectively indistinguishable from atheism. So that's where they use evolution as a tool to get people to reject the creator God. That's obviously a significant part of their motivation.
Philosophically, that even that is problematic, because if you imagine, even if you presume that we did evolve, our eyes, in theory, should give us real data about what we see, and our hands should give us real data about what we touch. So our, you know, even if we were evolved beings, what we feel religiously should give us real data about God.
Hey, could we do this? We only have a couple minutes left. Can we consider your article for the Answers Research Journal titled Towards a Creationary Classification of Mutations? This is fascinating to me, Jonathan Bartlett, because creationists, because of our understanding of reality and that God made us, we might be able to once again lead the scientific revolution and pull people along to this understanding, this expectation that just like we did with junk DNA, that's probably not junk, just wait and look and listen and learn, so too now with mutations, we'll be pulling people along to realize that, hey, not all mutations are created equally.
Yeah, the goal of the article was, because a lot of times we talk about mutations as being beneficial or harmful, and that's an okay classification.
Right.
But if you imagine if you're stuck under a boulder, cutting your arm off is beneficial to you.
Right.
But that's not necessarily part of your design.
Right.
And so the goal is to distinguish between things that are just good or bad versus, are they part of the design? So when we see things like our antibodies mutating in just the right spot, that gives us, you know, good evidence that those mutations are actually part of our design.
Mm.
And so what I did is I came up with a set of criteria that we can use to analyze mutations, and even if we don't know exactly how they work, some criteria to help us figure out whether or not they are consistent with our design,
right,
or whether they're inconsistent with our design.
So whether or not particular mutations were actually orchestrated intentionally, not the exact result, but the need to have variation at that point in the genome, at that moment. This is a fascinating topic, and I want to thank you so much, Jonathan Bartlett, for joining us. Give us the website for people to check out your writings and your research on this topic.
You can go to the www.blytheinstitute.org, and Blythe does not have an E on the end, so B-L-Y-T-H.
BLYTHinstitute.org. Jonathan Bartlett. Jonathan, thank you. And by the way, it's an honor to know that you tune in to Real Science Friday. I'll let Fred Williams know. In fact, he's excited to listen to this show. So thank you, Jonathan Bartlett.
Well, thank you for having me.
All right. That was a really enjoyable. Wow. Mutations are not necessarily random.
Stop the tape.
Hi, this is Bob Enyart interrupting my own show. That was stunning. So I'd like to review what we just heard. Many mutations are random and often harmful, but our body intentionally produces many of our mutations purposely for our benefit. For example, the antibodies in our white blood cells have millions of different designs that enable them to attach to millions of different germs. When a brand new germ enters your body, well, we often need a brand new kind of antibody. To get this on-demand antibody, so to speak, a small section of the DNA would have to be changed, mutated, to attack this new germ. But of the 3 billion base pairs in our human DNA, new antibody designs would occur only if a mutation happened in a tiny section of 600 base pairs, which is called Section B. Now, Section B codes only for the part of the antibody that attaches to the germ. Well, wonderfully, that specific part of our DNA has frequent mutations far more than the average. And the neighboring Section A, also made of 600 base pairs, which are like rungs on the DNA ladder, that part forms the other half of the antibody. And that part should not be mutated because doing so would harm the immune system. Thankfully, the mutations occur very frequently in Section B, where they tend to be beneficial, and not in Section A, where some might be neutral, but where most would likely be harmful or even lethal. About all this, many evolutionists cannot admit the obvious, that because there is a much higher incidence of mutations occurring where they are needed, that this is happening not by random chance, but intentionally, by design. This is virtually a tautology that they are denying. This cannot be happening randomly, as Darwinism would suggest, because if it were random, it would be happening throughout the DNA molecule, but this intensity of mutation is happening just where we need it most, and that's the opposite of random. Hey, I think atheists are afraid of evidence for the designer. RealScienceFriday.com.